after Sayaka and the boys left. She had distributed hundreds of presents she had purchased in Castavriel to our staff and vassals. She had been very busy in Castavriel's many exotic markets, but providing a few creature comforts, delicacies and luxuries to our people made us feel good. Some nobles focus on giving gifts to their social superiors, and if I didn't keep getting promoted without trying to, I might have. As it was, I valued the loyalty of my folk more than I coveted higher title. I didn't mind the expense one bit. The summer months delighted Alia, despite our snowflake livery, and she sponsored a day of swimming and play at the mill pond for all of the children of the Vale, to celebrate midsummer, a few days before I left. She also hosted a celebration for the boys in Beauval Manor who had completed their summer militia training, and she endeared herself to the Tal Alon in Hollyborough forever by both presenting Master Olmeg with a handsome and expensive weirwood staff and granting the borough a distilling permit. In Sevendor she was in her element, a true lady of the land. Her people looked up to her, admired her, respected her, loved her. My wife was beloved by the people I depended upon to protect my family, and her presence and actions had enriched them all. How could I think of doing anything to destroy that? I agonized over the question of whether or not to discuss it, but as the days before I left evaporated, I admit I buried the matter in my mind. Isili was not popping out of the bushes, despite my fears. I wasn't even supposed to know about the child. I focused on my duties and tried to put it out of my mind lest someone, particularly my wife, suspect something was amiss. An important enough distraction arrived when Lorcus returned from his mission to investigate Mage Lord Dunsalan. The man arrived late in the night, and I was due to make a trip to Brestal early the next day. But I stayed up and entertained him on top of my tower with a bottle of wine and a smoke while he reported what he'd witnessed. I thought it would be better to discuss this in person rather than mind to mind, Lorcus explained when we were comfortable. Dunsalan is a mage of burning ambition, but he's going mad. Mad? Explain. He's sane enough most times, Lorcus conceded, but he's prone to fits of rage when things don't go his way. Like a big 5-year-old, with Irionite, and lances of knights at his command. I think there were a few disaffected at first, Lorcus revealed, but he was at court long enough to know how to get rid of the discontents and reward his own supporters in his native domain. Soon everyone in his domains was feeling belligerent against their neighbors. He got them properly stirred up before he found an excuse to declare war. I recalled one poor knight who had fallen victim to Dunsalan's ambitions last year. I had not been able to do anything about it then. I still didn't have much leverage. I could hardly fault the man for playing by the rules and winning. I'd done it enough myself. How is he using magic to affect the outcome of the battles? Oh, he's employing professional war magi for one, Lorcus supplied. He's got 3 of them in service now. He supplies the power with his stone. They do the work. Quite an elegant application of Imperial-style thaumaturgy, actually, he said respectfully. But they've focused on entrapment and ambushes. That's how he's paying for it all. The ransoms. But he's also conducted night raids, misdirection, and some tricks with bridges that have been quite effective. He's even got his footmen riding now since he's captured so many horses. So how is that madness? That's perfectly sane, agreed Lorcus. What he does after a conquest is not. You know how the Lord technically has a right to anything in the domain? Well, he's extending that to the pick of women. He lines them up and selects 2 or 3 for himself, then dissolves everyone's marriages to let his men pick over the rest. The result is messy, he said, after searching for an apt term. That's not particularly savory or honorable, I agreed, but it's not madness. It is when those women are never seen again, Lorcus interrupted. I spoke with one poor carpenter who was out of his mind. His young wife was among the first of his conquests. She's been gone for over a year now, and Dunsalan's people won't even let him into the castle to inquire about her anymore. The rumor is, well, that he's keeping them in his dungeon, for unsavory purposes. That's okay, that's bordering on madness, I admitted. Then this crosses the frontier, Lorcus continued. Imprisoning your unwilling courtesans is bad enough. Insisting upon being called grandfather and have every man, woman, and child under your control treat you like a demigod upon pain of flogging ties the knot. He is building a shrine in his domain to himself. He's already commissioned a statue. So how are his new subjects reacting? They're terrified. They fear angering the man. He's burned down more than one man for defying him, using magic, and no one wants to cross him now. You can't draw a sword effectively when you're on fire, I've noticed, he said with a sad smile. He has a circle of thugs and mercenaries, especially those war magi, to back him up. I didn't even try to interview him after I saw how loyal they were to him, and how mercurial was his disposition. Not even the local barons want to mess with him now. So, what is your advice? I asked. You wanted a problem to solve. What is your solution? He's determined to reconquer all of his family's old lands and then expand them, Lorcus decided. That wouldn't be so bad in and of itself. It's good to have ambition. But he's tarnishing the good name of the High Magi everywhere by his methods. Should I take his stone back? You'd have to. I don't think he's going to give up his stone willingly, oath or no oath. Not after all he's built with it. I would remove him from his position and put him at some task, along with the sternly worded warning. Then I'd take a stone if he didn't comply. I'll take it under advisement, I agreed. I thought that was all, but Lorcus had more. There was one other thing. Dunsellin had snowstone. I thought for a moment. I sent him a small sample last year as a courtesy, I remembered. I did that to several leading scholars to get their ideas on it. You didn't send him 100 pounds of it, Lorcus countered. A black chest full of the stuff arrived while I was there. It wasn't the first either, if the gossip of the guards is any indication. But I'm not selling snowstone to him, I said. I had set the price on the substance high, since I didn't want too much of it around. I had a list of people who wanted it, and Dunsellin wasn't on that list. That's what I figured. So I checked into it. He's getting it from a small mine. In Sashtalia. Sashtalia? I asked in disbelief. Your little magic circle cuts across the back end of a little domain in Sashtalia, just over the ridge, Lorcus explained. Someone there is mining the stone surreptitiously. Only for a few clients. But Dunsellin is definitely one of them. Gods! What is he doing with it all? He's enriching his domain. He's arcanely fortifying his ancestral home. He's sprinkling those rocks everywhere and slathering on defensive spells like Sharul was outside. It's me he's afraid of, I sighed. He knows I will have to come for him if he continues this course. Actually, I think he's more worried about the censorate forces who are secretly aiding his opponents, Lorcus disagreed. Found that out, too, while I was nosing around. 3 former censorate war magi are helping the target of Dunsellin's next bit of conquest, and the one beyond that. They're providing the other knights with spells and casting wards and such. Not at a high magic level, but certainly enough to detect his movements and the disposition of his forces. The snowstone mine is actually more worrisome than the censorate, I decided. I'll have Sayake look into it while I'm gone. He's over toward that way at his own estate with my boys anyway. They can take a quick stroll and investigate. Thanks, Lorcus, I said with genuine gratitude. Get some rest, and I'll catch you up on what's been happening in Sevendor before I leave on the morrow. I tried to spend as much time with Alia, Minalian, and the baby as possible before I left. The war was tepid at best right now, and I didn't anticipate anything bad happening. But the gods have their own plans. Any time I strap on a mage blade, I knew it might be for the last time. Minalian was getting bigger, stronger, and more manlike every day, it seemed to me. We took him and the baby down to the mill pond at dusk a few days before I was to leave, and pulled rank to get exclusive use of the place after the workmen had washed off for the day. Minalian was doing his best to be entertaining, howling like a wolf, loudly enough to get the dogs that seemed to follow us everywhere to join him, squealing unbearably at the cold water on his toes, and splashing maniacally at the pond water he sat in while his doting parents looked on. "Such a big boy," Alia said admiringly. as he enjoyed the mud on the warm summer's day. Can you believe he's a year and a half old now? I thought about his little sister, Isili's daughter, not Almina, and how she would be about the same age. They had only been born a few months apart. That made me think of Isili, and the danger she still posed to my family. To me. I tried to hide my uneasiness, but some thoughts are just too loud to hide from your wife.
Minilin? What is it?
She asked, concerned. The war. I lied, automatically. I'm about to go tour our mighty fortifications, and I know that they're woefully inadequate. Why hasn't the dead god launched his attack while we were still reeling from the invasion? It's nearly midsummer, and no more than a few thousand troops have come down the timber road. Yet they defend it bitterly.
Why?
Because they plan on using it later, Alia supplied. She had gotten very good at being my sounding board for this sort of thing, and it beat talking about the real reason for my guilty conscience.
They're using it for slaves right now,
but they are still preparing something. But that gives us a whole year's reprieve to put our defenses in place, I said, shaking my head. There are over 10,000 of them in Karan Bol Barony. They're doing little but raiding villages and pillaging manor houses. It makes no sense.
Unless Shirul wants all of our troops deployed, she said logically, then it would make perfect sense.
A bigger army to smite, I ventured, or more worthy foes. That seems a little too chivalrous for the old skull.
Unless he wants you to screen one part of the kingdom so that he may strike at another target,
offered Alia, as our son gurgled joyfully at the water's edge.
But what? Southern Alshar?
The Ashari Riverlands aren't nearly the prize that Gilmore is, and he'd run smack up against the Colleens before he got to the coast. If he tries to go east, he gets caught between our forces in southern Gilmore and Tudri. He's not that stupid.
That's why you have to go, she said softly. You have to figure it out.
I looked at her. It's not what I want to do, I insisted. It's what I have to do.
I know,
she sighed, resigned.
That's the hardest part about being married to you. The same things I think are wonderful about you are the ones that compel you to go off and do stupid, dangerous things.
I do it for you, I said, sadly. If I don't, who will? Rard? The man is far more concerned with his legacy than his kingdom's security. Salgo? He's a fine soldier, but he doesn't make policy. Hartarian? He's enjoying the comfort and security of his new posting. He's not anxious to stick his neck out. So no one but me is looking out for you and our children.
I just wish it didn't have to be you all the time, she said in frustration. I know you'll be safe. This isn't even a real battle or anything, but I can't help but worry.
I wish I could say there was no cause, I agreed. But the Penumbra is a dangerous place. I'm keeping my presence and itinerary secret, and only taking a few men with me. I'm just going to make a quick run up through Tudri and Megalin, probably inspect one of the new Iron Ring forts, have some beer with some old comrades, and get back here as quickly as possible.
Just hurry,
she pleaded. I begrudge every day you spend away from us with that stupid war.
We both do, she said, glancing at Minelian. He's not going to be a baby forever.
Neither is the baby. Which is why I've spent as much time as possible with him while I'm here, I pointed out. That was the truth, too. When Alia wasn't tending him directly, I often had the baby brought to my workshop or the Great Hall, just to be around him. He was a happy, engaging little baby, and my day was not complete without trying to eat his toes at least a few times.
You are an excellent father,
she assured me. You spend almost as much time with him as I do.
Just don't do anything stupid and deprive yourself of the pleasure of yelling at him through his adolescence. I don't think I can handle him alone, much less a girl.
I'll try not to inconvenience you with my untimely death, I mocked.
See that you don't,
she insisted. You don't want me cross with you for the rest of eternity. Chapter 11 Verone. Lady Verin was kind enough to assist in my transport to Alshar through the Alka Alon waypoint to begin my tour.
The three emissaries had been granted wide latitude on letting me use their private magics, but as long as I required their assistance and knowledge, they didn't seem to mind. It spared me and my people days on the road and the discomfort of inns and camps. That it was so much easier to do with the help of Snowstone was not lost on me, either. For this trip, I chose to take only Sir Festarin and the new war mage I was interviewing, Alscott the Fair. He was the perfect companion for touring a military installation, a veteran mercenary war mage more used to camps than courts. He had already fought at Cambrian and had been assisting in counterinsurgency operations in Gilmora when he got the message that he was next in line. Going back to the front, after hearing about the idyllic land of Sevendor, didn't suit him well. But he grudgingly admitted that few knew it better than he. Sir Festarin was also eager. He'd had but a taste of battle, and he did not consider himself full-blooded as a knight yet. He would serve in the stead of my apprentices. Dara was no kind of war mage, and a military fort is not the best place for a 14-year-old girl. Rondol and Tyndall were getting their asses trounced on the lists by the squires of Chepstan, so I appreciated the soft-spoken, earnest young knight's assistance. It would help give Sir Festarin an opportunity for some seasoning. Besides, he was well-trained for service, and he was used to the ways of magi by now. And I had to admit, his magical talent of accurate estimation came in handy in some unlikely ways. My goal on this tour was to oversee the progress of the magical defences, particularly our installations near to the Umbra. The king's strategy of containment mirrored the Alca Alons, and the castles and forts of the Penumbra were the first line of defence against another campaign into the heartland of the realm. That it had failed to stop the Gavani's conquest and use of the Cotton Road for their invasion into Gilmora was well known in court. There was a hole in the metaphorical wall around the Shadow, and it spelled disaster for the Riverlands. There was a hue and cry among the dispossessed barons of Gilmora, in particular, who wanted every lad with a spear who could be spared to retake northern Gilmora. Lords from farther away were more insistent that the king spare what forces he could to effectively seal the hole. The Iron Ring military order had been established to contain the threat, but it was still in development. Only four fortresses had been manned around the perimeter of Shirul's domain so far, and the officer corps was still arguing about the order's proper name. The Megalini Knights had patrolled the frontier aggressively, and Astaral's magical corps, with much of the Horkan order of war magi in residence, held the strategic town of Tudri. But the cold fact was that our first line of defence was ragged and inconsistent. It didn't help that the Gavani were defending their possession of the Cotton Road, which starts as the Timber Road, valiantly. There had been dozens of attempts to re-seize control of the Plank Road, but every one of them had been eventually overcome by fresh goblin troops within a few days. I expected that to herald a much greater thrust. But the forces descending the road were focusing on the human harvest of Gilmora, not preparing for another offensive. Yet. While that gave us some valuable time to raise the forces needed for a stout defence, it also pointed to a much different strategy than the full frontal assault we'd expected. The king needed to know where to send the troops he was raising in Rhemir and Wenshar and the Castali Wilderlands, in Gilmora or in the Penumbra, and he was relying on my intelligence to help him make that decision. So, I was off to the front to see for myself. Yet I didn't want to just appear in the middle of things and end up getting a bunch of official tours. I wanted to see conditions for myself. I had Varen transport us to the site of an abandoned refuge, just south of Verone. We would make the rest of the way overland. I'd kept my party small and my itinerary secret to facilitate a fresh look at the place. Why Verone? Because it was the next largest city to Tudri, and as such, it had become a staging area and supply depot for our military operations in the Penumbra. It was where the refugees from the Wilderlands had congregated. I was curious to see the city myself, after hearing of its fallen condition from Master Thinrattle. The transport point was in a wood, a few miles away from a manor house, where I'd quietly arranged, thanks to the help of the Hessian Order, who had a depot in Verone, for three horses to be waiting for us. We were on our way north to the city by mid-morning, enjoying the sunny weather and keeping the heat at bay with magic. The peasants we passed along the road were going about their business with grim determination, and I didn't see a single one without a stout staff, a cudgel, or a long knife at their belt. A casual conversation at the inn we stopped in for lunch revealed that Gavanni raids from the Penumbra were frequent, even if they were sporadic. Since most of the fighting men had been assigned to the front, the peasantry, who were left, had to arm themselves any way they could against the possibility of sudden attack. The palisades of the town were watched every night, we were told, and many of the nearby cottagers had taken to sleeping in the manor or the small shrine. The more northerly we went, the worse conditions got. Before we left the barony, we passed two hamlets, abandoned in the wake of an attack. Half the cots burned husks. We were greeted at the frontier by four mail-clad men, with halberds and crossbows, who seemed very curious about who we were and where we were going. It took a menacing growl from Alscott to quiet them. He's a good-looking fellow, but when that pleasant smile turns nasty, it can have a withering effect. The country leading into Verone was torn, with a ruined cottage for every two that still stood. A row of 13 goblin heads on poles at one crossroad warned of the dangers in the land. As grisly as it was, it was nothing compared to the horrid shrines the Gavanni liked to leave behind. We passed through two checkpoints before reaching the city gates. Each time the men were clearly expecting a bribe, and quickly backed down when it was said we were on the king's business. The roads around the checkpoints were dotted with makeshift encampments, some no more than a lean-to made from branches and rushes. Some were fortunate enough for a bit of blanket or sackcloth to tie overhead. The inhabitants of the shelters were gaunt and bony. They wore rags sometimes, or clothes clearly looted from their betters and ruined in their fallen estate.
"Huin, save them,"
Sir Festaren said, making the sign of the good god. Alscott laughed.
"This lot, they're living the life compared to some poor sods I've seen. They're not half starved yet. It is still summer. Wait until winter, then you will see them in trouble."
A little closer to the gate, in what may have once been a hayfield, a much vaster camp was spread. Here the shelters were more substantial, and the refugees perhaps a little better fed, but the look of fear, grief, and hopelessness in their eyes was unmistakable, as was the smell. There is a stench of despair that accompanies such loss, and it hung over Verone like a cloud. Nor was that the only encampment. We passed three more, of various sizes, as we made our way to the city gates. The closer we got, the more they became little shanty towns. One even had a kind of market, where folk bartered what few belongings they had left for the basic necessities of life. I heard accents from the Minden Vales, from the foothills of the Wilderlands, from the Pearwoods, and from other remote places as we rode by. There were a couple of bored-looking men with spears posted at the entrance to the settlement, but apart from that there seemed to be little order. There was a little cluster of huts in one copse of woods which proved to be a primitive brothel. Widows and maidens alike had been prompted by necessity to sell Ishi's blessings to sustain themselves. Old men and women who had walked for hundreds of miles through the Wilderlands peered up at us, their eyes hopeless, their wrinkled faces begging toothlessly for a few pennies. It was a scene that evoked my utter pity. These were the lucky ones, I reminded myself. These were the ones who escaped. But to leave the danger behind, to be forced to live like this.
"How many are there?"
I asked in wonder. Sir Festaren's eyes got a distant look in them.
"I would say 30,000? Maybe 35?
On this side of the river?" he added. "I haven't seen what lies beyond it yet." Verone was bisected by a beautiful river surrounded by picturesque hills. It supposedly marked the beginning of the Wilderlands, by some estimations, but it was situated where it was mostly for the delightful view. Defensively, it was a poorly situated location. The city proper was on an island in the middle of the river, and it was covered in gorgeously appointed residences, but little fortifications. As the ducal summer capital, Verone had been designed as a resort domain, featuring hunting and fishing and hawking, not the production of crops to feed the people. The artisans there were used to selling their wares to the idle aristocracy of the court, not crafting weapons of war. As a staging ground, it was only somewhat strategically located and not particularly suited to the task. I know. I'd led an army from Verone once. The guards at the gatehouse were taciturn, and continued to doubt our story until I pulled rank on them. They did not want to let us in until we told them our business. I insisted that our business was private, and they pointed out that it was their business to keep the wrong sort out of our own. So I pulled rank. I was technically still a Marshal of Alshar, entitled to press into service any loyal Alshari warrior in defense of the realm. Once I'd given him my warrants, we were escorted through the city to the quarter with the wealthiest inns. The Arcane Order had yet to establish a chapter house here, and to look at the place, I wondered if we ever would. There was no real reason for this city to exist anymore. The Duchy of Alshar was riven. In the north, the dead gods Umbra rotted away, spreading to the penumbra, while in the south, rebellious barons had seized the moment, and the coastward capital of the duchy, Phalas, and cut off all but nominal ties to the duchy. That left a thin strip of free land between the two, a mere stump of a proper duchy. There was no political cohesiveness anymore. That was sad. Once Alshar had been, well, if not mighty, at least picturesque and colourful. The Dukes of Alshar had distinguished themselves in several important ways over the centuries. Now the heir to the coronet, the future Duke Anguin, was a virtual hostage to the king and queen against his cooperation. He had been granted the nominal title to his broken duchy, but not invested in it. The nobles who remained loyal were loyal to King Rard, not that poor orphan boy. Meanwhile, Varone suffered. Bereft of any greater purpose than protecting refugees and storing supplies destined for the fortresses and armies in the north, Varone was now a ghost of its former self. The inns were crowded with desperate men and women who squandered what money they had salvaged on a hostel's roof. Shops and artisans who once peddled their wares had closed their doors, or worked only by appointment, we were told at the inn we chose, the Silver Pillow. Once the homey haunt of knights and lords, the aristocracy who lived within its shabby luxury now were the dregs of the wilderlands. Most did not have the funds or the means to go further south. Others schemed to recover the lands they'd lost in the penumbra. Most just worried and complained and took the innkeeper to task for his poor fare. We learned at table that evening that the city was ruled by Baron Edmarin now, on behalf of the duchy. Mostly His Excellency's job was to keep the nearby army camp provisioned and provide place for refugees to be quartered. Actually, city services and administration were nearly non-existent, and a robust criminal underclass had erupted in its place. Gangs ran rampant, their affiliations declared by coloured armbands, or baldrics. Their influence was largely reserved to the camps and to the poorer parts of town. But if what you did failed to involve the soldiers moving through town, it wasn't regulated by what was left of civil authority. Some things were had at a bargain. Beer, spirits, smoke, and food could all be had at a price, and the choice of whores was limitless. That made the inns and taverns nearest the army encampment lucrative waters for the criminals who procured the whores and then robbed the clients. Nor did the mass of displaced folk feel that they could easily flee. Farther south, there was the devastation of Gilmora, and the way along the timber road was shut to them. To the west were the imposing Mindens. After the scant foothills, which were sparsely populated at best, the highland countryside at the source of the Poros and the Nuliar rivers was torn and broken and nearly uninhabitable, the land subject to the same goblin raids that they were fleeing. Only to the east did the hope of escape lie, and Castal, it seemed, had shut its frontier to most of those who fled. I was appalled to hear that. I checked with Master Harterian, mind to mind, and the royal court wizard reluctantly agreed that the rumour was true. While the kingdom's policy was officially to allow the refugees to cross the frontier, the Duke of Castal had elected to restrict the access to a reasonable number, lest his facilities be overwhelmed. The Duke of Castal was Rard's son, Prince Tavard. As such, he would not have done anything as Duke of Castal that his father and monarch did not want him to. Rard was gaining prestige and respect for publicly protecting and aiding the refugees on the one hand, and then denying that protection and aid when it came to carry through. Sure, refugees are a logistical nightmare. How you fed, clothed, and housed a displaced population was daunting, akin to supplying an army's needs without the resources an army has to offer in return. But to promise aid and protection in public and then deny it, that was contemptible. It wasn't a universal closure. Sufficient coin or the proper documentation would carry you through the checkpoints, as it always does. But if you were destitute, you were unlikely to cross. Not only did that leave me doubting the humanity of the royal house, it gave Shirul a mass of humanity upon which to potentially feed close at hand to the penumbra. That was a danger I could not ignore. The next morning, I made my way to the impressive-looking palace and demanded to speak to the baron who had been given the job of running the city. I detailed Sir Festaren and Alscott to quietly investigate the refugee camps and the army encampment, respectively, while I took my concerns to the military governor. It took 3 hours and 4 levels of flunkies, but I finally managed to catch him preparing to go hawking just after luncheon, and just before I started magically tearing the place down. I had mixed feelings about seeing the mildewy old palace. It had been at Verone where I had effectively blackmailed the Duke into giving me what I wanted, an army and a marshalate, and convinced him to enter the war in earnest. It was a decision which cost him his life, and that of his wife. The place was far shabbier than it was 2 years before, although it didn't lack for servants. But instead of the stately demeanor of a ducal household, they carried on with little regard for propriety or the sanctity of the property in their charge. It felt more like an army camp or bandit's lair than an administrative center. When we were finally led to where Baron Edmarin was preparing for the day's amusement, I was at a well-controlled boil. The Baron proved to be an older man, well-dressed and clearly at home in his mediocrity. He was examining a number of falcons held out for his inspection, his horse and a party of gentlemen waiting nearby. The Castellan quietly introduced us, but the Baron did not stop his examination of the hunting birds.
"My lord, Spellmonger," he said in feigned surprise, "what brings you to our fair little city?"
"The city is not fair," I corrected, "and my title is Mage Lord. Baron, if you want to be precise, but Mage Lord is sufficient and more helpfully descriptive. I find myself compelled to ask how you feel hawking is an appropriate pastime when there are clearly higher priorities in Verone."
"Mage Lord," he answered nonplussed, "I have been at this position for 9 months now. If I concerned myself with every petty injustice and hard luck story that wandered to my gates, I would be doing nothing else. Nor are the resources to which I am entitled sufficient to do more than relieve a tithe of the burden placed upon the people of Alshar. We have devoted the majority of the ducal tribute to their relief," he offered. "Yet there seem to be no end of them, and the ducal tribute is, alas, far less than it once was.
Yet you see fit to go hawking anyway. We must not let the trials of the gods keep us from gentlemanly pursuit," he offered.
"And the hunting up here is simply magnificent. Last autumn we took a 200-pound boar, the most vicious beast I've ever slain. Magnificent," he repeated.
"And did that boar grace your table, Your Excellency?" I asked evenly.
"Of course," he said indignantly. "But I donated the 3 dogs it killed to the poor devils outside the gate. The gods know I am a charitable man," he said proudly.
I decided to change the subject. He was clearly not going to be moved by an appeal to his nobility. "Those are beautiful birds," I said, looking more closely at a red-winged hawk. I was learning a bit about such things, now that Darrow was around to teach me. I'd even flown Frightful a few times.
"I've got dozens of the beastly things," he snorted. "It's as if every wilderland's lord who could escape with anything of value brought his birds with him. Then learned quickly how expensive life in a war zone can be, and I picked them up cheaply. The mews is filled to overflowing, and it is a large mews. I swear I hunt them out of charity for their well-being. The poor things get so little exercise if they aren't properly flown."
"Any larger birds?" I asked, knowing that Dana would ask me. She and Ithalia had been mad for large raptors lately.
"Large? I've got over a score of Wilderland silvers," he said proudly. "The Wilderlords are mad for them. Huge, hulking things, utterly vicious. But there's no art to them,"
he said sadly. Not like these fine little ladies. Yes, I'll take these three, not those, he instructed his hawk master. If I don't find a buyer for them, though, I'll end up serving them to the refugees, he promised. They eat ravenously, and if they aren't flown, they're expensive to feed. I thought of 20 birds like Dara's beautiful frightful, having their necks summarily wrung, plucked and cooked in a pot. I wouldn't blame a starving man for doing it, I suppose, but it was a dreadful waste of a magnificent animal. I'll buy the lot of them, I proposed. Every silver rat do you have?
Really?
Baron Edmarin asked, surprised.
I had not heard you were interested in birds.
One of my apprentices has introduced me to the hobby, and I'd like to give her a present, I said, truthfully. I've been considering taking up the hobby myself. I'll pay you 20 ounces of gold for each one delivered to Sevendor.
Done,
he said happily, his eyes bulging at the price. He had clearly paid significantly less.
I'll make the arrangements at once. You really think you can handle 20 such big brutes?
I'll learn, I pledged, but most will be gifts to vassals, I think. How lies the army outside the gates? I asked, changing the subject again. King Rad and the warlord will be wanting a complete report from me, I explained.
Well enough, though it is less an army than a depot, he admitted. 1,000 men stationed permanently to guard the stores and supplies, another 2,000 in the garrison. Beyond that, the soldiers there await deployment north, or are being sent home wounded.
So if any force came at the city in earnest, how many could be fielded?
3,000? Maybe 5,000, depending, he shrugged. All but 500 infantry. If there happens to be a mercenary unit in transit, perhaps more. But there's no way the Scruggs would venture here. They went right past us, down the road to Gilmora. If they wanted Verone, they would have taken it.
I didn't want to debate military strategy with the man. Not only was his grasp of the situation suspect, but it was clear he was more concerned about living well off the city's decaying corpse than seeing it survive. I didn't like that, but there was little I could do about it. His was a royal appointment. Even as Marshal of Alshar, I could not dispute that. I could beg a boon of him, however. It occurs to me that it would be helpful for the arcane orders to have a more pronounced presence in the region, I said, thoughtfully, as he strapped on his flying leathers. It would be strategically helpful. Tell me, are any of the spaces within the city available?
Actually, there are a few old homes and mansions here, he agreed amiably. Most belong to great houses of the duchy, who use them when at the summer court, and nearly every little lordling in the wilderness wanted to have a place in the summer capital when the duke heard their cases. There is a whole street of such little mansions. Some are mere cots, but still more grand than the dirt-floored halls they call a home.
He had a riverlord's contempt for the rough-edged wilderlords. I stopped. Every lordling.
The duke made such residences affordable to the nobility by edict, Edmarin explained in a bored tone. It kept the city's craftsmen busy and allowed the nobles an opportunity to house their kin at court without inconvenience. And he disliked tents.
Baron Edmarin chuckled with a fond memory.
It was said it made sleeping with the wives of his vassals more comfortable and convenient, but I knew the old boy. I doubt he had that much ambition. Why, do you wish to purchase one?
He asked, amused. Mayhap, if one is available.
Oh, plenty are available. Most are in good condition, too. I've kept the street clear of looters and squatters, mostly. I'm sure I could find you a suitable residence, if the price is right.
I could tell he'd profit handsomely from the deal. I wasn't particularly inclined to line his purse, but I didn't want to say so. Thank you, my lord. I nodded. I'll take a look at a few and let you know which I like.
And you'll still be wanting those birds?
He asked, hungrily. Definitely. And any falconer who accompany them will be assured a secure post at the end of his journey, I promised. You have the spellmonger's word on that. After I left the Baron to his birds, I got in touch with Sire Kay, through Rondal, who was still travelling with him. I inquired as to whether or not Sire Kusi, Sire Kay's former master, and current puppet of the dead god, ever maintained a residence in Verone, and learned that House Brandmount had indeed maintained a modest hostel there. He had stayed there himself several times, when the business of his master took him so far. He told me where it was located, after catching me up on my apprentice's progress in errantry. I met up with Sir Festaren and Alscott near the gate to the palace, and then made our way to House Brandmount's townhome. It was a pleasant affair, constructed of exposed beam and plaster, and rising 3 stories tall. The sharply peaked roof was done in slated tile, not thatch, and was indeed nicer than anything Coucy had lived in Beauval Vale. Beauval Castle was big, compared to other domain-level fortifications, but it was plain and sparse, designed for war, and not comfort. The house proved deserted. The lock on the door looked imposing, but Alscott enchanted it into rusty wreckage in moments. Inside, we found the house was prepared for sudden arrivals, with wood laid in the fire and even a little food stored away. Though more than a year's dust had settled within, there were sheets ready in presses near the empty straw ticks on the beds. The arms of House Brandmount loomed here and there, but other than that, the home was cheery enough. "I think we just found Sevendor's new embassy to Alshar," I decided. "I mean, technically, I suppose this already belongs to me. I did remove Sire Coucy from power before the Dead God came. I didn't file an official writ of conquest or anything, and the point is pretty moot, but I feel entitled to the place."
"What if someone objects to that?" asked Alscott, amused.
"I'll be happy to have the discussion," I said. "Besides, Coucy owed me some back pay, I figure, for running that siege. That was court wizard work. I'll take this house in fee. I'll have our baggage moved here, and we'll take residence for now. Later it can be a presence for the Order in Verone or something. But right now it's a cozy, free, secure place to lay my head without dealing with strangers. So, gentlemen, tell me about your day. I want to hear your reports." Alscott went first, helping himself to a bottle of Coucy's wine.
"It wasn't as bad as I thought," he began. "The camp looks like shite, but it's not badly run. The Baron has precious little to do with it, other than authorizing payments to the garrison and approving the supplies from the south. The real commander is a little man named Sir Basque, and he's not bad at his job. He runs the supply depot and handles quartering for transient troops. The hospital is run by a bunch of monks, mostly war brothers, but some priests and nuns from other sects. The men are all eager to do well to avoid being posted north to Tudri, or worse. The Iron Band war brother I met there was doing good business, though. He had a string of 40 recruits headed for the Penumbra already, and he's only been here a few days. The recruiters hang around the gambling halls, and when some poor, desperate fucker gets into debt too deeply, the Iron Band offers to bail him out. There are rumors that the Order itself is fixing the dice."
"Unlikely, but that's an interesting notion. What about their defensive capabilities?"
"They'd fold like a broken leg," he said candidly, "against any disciplined force, that is. They have enough lads and enough steel to put up a fight, but it's not a frontline unit. It's not even a particularly good garrison unit. They barely patrol."
"Much activity in the area?"
"From what I heard, the Gavanni are leaving Verone alone, though they haven't spared many other domains. The closest raid was half a day's ride north, at the last full moon. About 200 dead or captured. The rest fled here. That's just on the edge of the Penumbra," he added grimly. "That's where things start getting really bad."
"How about the refugees, Fess?" I asked Sir Festaren. The young mage knight looked troubled, and not just by my casual presentation. The wine was good, and the fact it had been Coucy's made me want to inhale it. I wasn't particularly inclined toward formality in such a situation. Sir Festaren always tried to maintain a sense of formality, and I'm sure he was disturbed by me relaxing the social rules, as was my right as most senior in status. But that's not what was on his mind, as it turned out. "Mage Lord, I have never seen such suffering. By my estimate, there are 44,000 refugees in 9 major camps around the city. I spoke extensively with an abbot who directs the relief efforts. The man was pious enough, but pragmatic," he said, making a sour face.
"How so?"
"I pointed out a boy who was selling the favors of his 2 younger sisters. Girls not yet in flower," he added distastefully. The land brother not only knew it, but condoned it as necessary under the circumstances. The aid he gets from the palace is paltry. Maize fit only for horses, stale oats and mouldy barley. Meat is a rare treat and usually gets stolen and sold before it can be distributed. Therefore, without coin, however small, the children were not able to eat. I felt appalled myself. Could he not feed them from his stores? I asked him the same question, Mage Lord, he said, his face ashamed. He pointed out another dozen who were in a similar position, girls as young as 7, doing unspeakable things for men, just to eat. Gangs of boys roaming around, laying claim to territories and fighting to defend them. Mothers pimping their daughters and their sons. He could not feed them all, he told me. The most he could do was protect them from harm as best he could while they earned what they could and lived another day. There were 2 whole camps just of children, Mage Lord. 9,000 orphans and refugees, he said, his head sagging in despair. More arrive every day. The children apparently hide when the raiders come and escape notice. Their parents are captured and enslaved. But the children are not pursued. Too frail and intractable, most likely. But if they are caught, they are tortured in front of their parents to amuse the Gavani. So they run. And they end up here. 44,000, I said, shaking my head. At its height, this city held perhaps 20,000. Where are they to go? What is to become of them?
If they sit here, Mage Lord, they are little more than fodder for the sacrificial stone, reminded Alscott, conversationally. They do this in Gomorrah, raid the outer villages, and anyone who isn't snatched up runs to the nearest castle. Eventually, you get everyone in one place, far more than can be defended. Fear and desperation and hunger do their job for them. They can wait until they are ready to pluck the fruit from the tree when it is ripe.
We must figure out a way to avoid that, I sighed, feeling defeated. We've estimated over 150,000 or more have already gone into the Umbra and not returned. A few tens of thousands come out as soulless, mere slaves, and others hopelessly toil for the Gavani while they await slaughter. But so many have died already. We must deny them this resource. I stayed in Verone for 2 days while I summoned a passing high mage to occupy Bovar Vale's old residence on my behalf. The man, Brinduin, was a Horkan war mage coming off 4 months of duty, and he appreciated the easy posting. He also had 2 witch stones he'd captured, and was delighted to bring them to me in person. He was due 1,000 ounces of gold bounty for each one. He agreed to watch the place for us and enjoy the flesh pots of Verone until he was relieved. I don't know why I felt so strongly about claiming that house in a city no one cared about. But some part of me saw it as the last bit of Bovar Vale not under shadow, and that gave me hope. The night before we left for Tudri, I used magic to tear down the arms of House Brandmount and then enchanted the wood of the door with an arcane sigil like a mage light, a glowing green snowflake. The place belonged to me now. I was sure it would come in handy eventually. Chapter 12. The Penumbra. 2 days' ride north of Verone told us we were in the Penumbra, that zone of chaos and destruction outside of the dead god's direct domain. Proved to be a scattered patchwork of settlements now. The Wilderlands was never thickly settled, and the farther north you go, the fewer and further between the people are. There was a decided change in the countryside since the start of the war, however. The forests were already reaching out to overgrow the villages abandoned 2 years ago. Even the bones of the defeated and eaten were disappearing under the brush, thankfully. But like the weeds that were growing between the stones of the abandoned halls, human life persisted in the Penumbra. The route between Tudri and Verone was better settled, since it was routinely patrolled. A few knights had held out in their little fortresses nearest the road, protecting a handful of villeins who were compelled to work their plots, even in a war zone. But the farther from the road you went, as we found on our excursion, the fewer settlements there were. Bono's Ridge is a good example. Sir Bono was a knight who held a stout stone tower atop a ridge within sight of the Tudri Road,
a day and a half north of Verone. Bonner held tight while his neighbours fled, and he even invited their villeins, who had not the courage to flee or fight, to come live in his hall. As a result, his fields were tended, but at the cost of a man guarding the plots for every three working them. The troops coming up the road added to his purse and provided a market for his surplus. But if anything were to happen to that support, Bonner, as valiant as he portrayed himself to be at our meal in his hall, would not have held out long against the Gavanni. Other settlements were not as friendly. A day later we were ordered off the land of one Lord Salka, a noble bearing the arms of a red dithon on a yellow field, who ruled a village of 300 from his mott and bailey fortress atop a lone hill. He swore he wanted no truck with king or duke, and certainly with no mage lords. He was jealous of his domain and would have no rival. I saw a few shifty-eyed men lingering around the yard of his hall. If they had worn signs proclaiming them agents of Sherald, they couldn't be more obvious. Yet I could not have objected without starting a battle. The men in the squat little keep were loyal to the man who had given them arms and offered his protection. Slaughtering them for that decision didn't seem right. The fourth day we finally made the outskirts of Tudri, where we were intercepted by a cavalry patrol. Once I showed my credentials, we were treated with the greatest of respect. We were quickly escorted to the city gate, where we were treated to a night at an inn, and then given leave to tour the city freely. Unlike Verone, the guards at the gate were keen-eyed and anxious at our approach. There were refugees here, displaced folk aplenty, but they were not the burden that they were to Verone. At Tudri, everyone worked. The city I'd visited nearly 3 years before had been transformed. It was smaller now, now that many of the artisans and small folk had deserted it. But those who lingered in Tudri did so with purpose. If Verone lacked a reason for being, Tudri's was the defiance of the dead god, and it showed. I left my old war comrade, Asterol, in command of the city when it had been the site of one of the opening battles of the war, using my borrowed authority as Marshal of Alshar to make the appointment. The man had taken the position seriously. Tudri was the last major bastion of human civilization before the onslaughts of the dead god, and the first line of defense for the rest of the kingdom. Asterol had done everything in his power with the resources he had to ensure the best possible defense, as well as ensuring the continued survival of the strategic city. The folk of Tudri had adopted new arms since the takeover to signify their defiance of the invasion. A white and blue standard featuring a blue portcullis on a white field, surrounded by 3 5-pointed blue mage stars. The banner seemed to fly from every home in Tudri. As we rode through the cobbled streets of Old Town, we were greeted by the busy business of everyday folk. But this wasn't a mining depot and market town anymore. Tudri had the feel of an army town now. I could tell when I first crossed the gate. There were soldiers everywhere. The garrison here numbered over 10,000, fully a third of the population. Most of these were now on the king's payroll. Levies from the south and the east were billeted in new towns' abandoned homes, or in the big camp that had sprung up in the commons. The walls were patrolled day and night. Cavalry patrols issued forth every few hours, and the raucous sounds of the kind of drunken revelry only soldiers deployed in a war zone can produce seemed to emanate from the door of every inn and taproom. Unlike Baron Edmarin, Asterol did not keep me waiting one moment. Our horses were taken from us, and we were immediately ushered to the mage lord's presence in a small hall in the former mayor's palace. There I found my old friend behind a bulwark of parchment. "So, you have come to see us again at last," he said, after introductions were made and wine served by a shapely maiden. Asterol looked as at home in his position as Edmarin had, but he lacked the other commander's exploitive nature. He was home, not at a post he planned on looting. "It's been too long, but I hope what I have done meets with your approval," he said, pouring my men and me wine from a large glass bottle. It was good. Only a few varieties of grapes grew this far north, but the Wild the Lords had made a point of cultivating at least enough for wine. "You're still here," I pointed out, sipping the robust Wilderland's vintage. "That's more than I expected at this point.
To be honest, it's more than I expected as well, the handsome Gilmoran mage confided. We haven't had a decent attack in months. I don't know why the goblins have left us alone, but I can only assume it's because we're just too tough. His sarcastic tone belied his words. So why are they really leaving you alone? I asked. Honestly? He asked seriously. Because they don't need the problem. We're a threat to them, perhaps, but not enough of one to goad. Our patrols and sorties into the penumbra are a nuisance, but in truth we've been able to do very little against them without endangering our security. So we sit here and send out patrols and supply the Iron Ring, and we kill whatever goblins we come across. But in vain. There are 6 more for everyone we slay.
But are you being opposed more or less? Asked Alscott, curious. 6 months ago you were getting raids every week. There are legions still encamped half a day's march of Tudri, he said, gesturing at a big map of the region on the wall behind him. If I send enough force to counter them, I leave the town vulnerable. If they try to invest the town, we can defend against them until relief arrives. So we play this game, he sighed. We advance a patrol through their territory, they send a raid into ours. Nothing ever decisive. But meanwhile, coffles of slaves a mile long are being marched up the road into shadow. Some we can save, and do, but then we have to feed them, he said, shaking his head. I send who I can south to Varun. It's a piss-poor life, but at least they're safe there. I wouldn't be so certain, I said, shaking my own head. I've just come from there. It's becoming a festering boil, ripe for the lancing, should the Gavanni take an interest. 44,000 refugees now. And more to come, he promised. Min, I can't help where these people end up. All I can do is save them from some shaman's knife. That has been my focus. I recruit as many of the men as I can and send the women and the weak down the road. They might die in Varun. They do die in Varun. But they die free, he emphasized, and not at the service of our enemy. I'm not taking you to task for your strategy, I assured him. I'm just trying to understand the war. My strategy has been to support the Iron Ring forts, he listed. Rescue what humans I can, patrol the Penumbra lands for prisoners and enemy troop movements, defend the town, protect the surrounding domains, and spend the king's coin wisely. Oh, and to give the poor bastards out patrolling a safe place for them to spend their hard-earned pay. That's been a recent focus, he added wryly. 2 whole streets in Old Town are now devoted to conquering the purses of the soldiers of the garrison. A noble pursuit. To your profit? I asked carefully. Astaroth was doing a difficult job. I didn't want to deter him by criticizing how he ran his lands. Me? No, no. I've ploughed the proceeds into the hospital complex in the west side of Old Town. We have hundreds, if not thousands, of cases. The revenues collected from the taverns and brothels pay the monks and healers who tend them. I don't need the money, he told me. I have plenty of revenue, and my vassals are almost guaranteed to stay loyal without bribes. But if I can get a wounded man shipped out to safety because a dozen of his mates got drunk and laid when they came back to town, it's a victory for us all. Astaroth was happy to allow me to inspect his troops, each bearing the blue portcullis and stars on a baldric. They were far better than the dregs I'd seen at Varone. That wasn't the only difference. There were hardly any magi at Varone. There was an entire neighborhood of them in Tudri. The war magi employed by the various orders had taken up residence in the district formerly reserved for the burghers. The Order of Horka had taken over the original digs, while the Order of Hesia had adopted a larger complex on the south side of the street. The whole neighborhood was now called Sparktown, and it was a sea of high magi flaunting their power between missions. When I entered Horka Hall, as it was now called, I was hailed as a comrade by everyone there. I was among friends and colleagues, men and women of valor, most of whom I had worked with closely. While unanticipated, the news of my presence in Sparktown spread quickly, until most of the magi in Tudri were crammed into the Horka Hall, getting me blind drunk. I should have expected it. I was among old comrades. But my presence had raised their morale significantly, as 2 of their number had perished in a recent raid on the Timber Road.
In honor of the fallen, I could not help but toast their memory. Things got a little hazy after I solemnly accepted the witch stones of the fallen war magi, along with a cup of Pearwood spirits. I gave a speech, I forget what I said, and I recall weeping openly, with Astaroth's arm around my neck.